All right, here we are. This is the Wednesday afternoon, June 17th session of the Portland City Council. Before I ask Carla to call the roll, thank you everybody for your incredible patience. We had a very, very long council session this morning that actually ran till well after 2 p.m. And the council, myself included, needed a bit of a break before we went into this because we want to give you our full, undivided, and enthusiastic attention as opposed to nailing it on the backside of a 7-hour long council session. So thank you for your patience. With that, Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Aye. I hear.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Wheeler?
I am here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members are attending remotely by video and teleconference, and the city has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and of course, Channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your continued patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. And with that, I will turn it over to our attorney to read the rules of order and decorum.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the City Council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. We only have two items today. The first is time certain item 492. Carla, could you please read that for us? Carla, you're muted.
Sorry about that. Approve funding recommendations made by Children's Levy Allocation Committee for July 1, 2020 to June 2023.
Thank you, Carla. I'm very pleased to introduce the next item, which comes from the Portland Children's Levy, asking us to approve $68 million in new community investments over a 3-year period beginning July 1st. If approved, this funding for 85 programs would reach city youth affected by generations of racial, ethnic, and economic inequity, as well as go towards emergency needs during this health pandemic, especially in Black, Indigenous, and communities of color. As you know, the levy was created back in 2002, and it's been renewed 3 times by Portland voters to prepare children for school, to support their success inside and outside of the classroom, reduce racial and ethnic disparities in their well-being in school. Today, we have levy director Lisa Pellegrino will take us through the funding process in the background, provide more details and context to the request, and of course, answer any questions anybody has about this. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen.
So you all can follow the slides along with me.
Thank you.
Okay, hang on a second. Let me just start the slideshow. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. And
is it working for anybody? I don't see the shared screen. Maybe I'm on.
Do not.
No, Commissioner okay. Hardesty.
All right, hang on. Okay. Let me get out of this. Hang on, let me escape. I meant to. Let's see.
Don't worry, Lisa. We've all been there, done that.
Okay, I thought I had down, Joanne, but I guess I did not. Okay, hang
you
on.
You know? We are doing fabulous. We are doing absolutely fabulous with this new technology.
Oh, she's getting it though. Look
there
at
we
that.
Go.
It's
right,
there.
I got it. Okay, now let me see if I can get the slideshow function. So we're going to make that work. Ah, there we go. Okay, that's better.
Ta-da,
all right, thank you all for your patience. I'm a little green at this still and doing presentations online. Getting better slowly. Again, thank you all for your time. Good afternoon. I know it's been a marathon day for you all, and so I'll do my best to move briefly. We are before you, as Mayor said, requesting approval of the allocation committee decisions in the recent competitive funding round, allocating a little over $68 million for the next three fiscal years into 85 program grants. The PCL, is governed by a five-member allocation committee, and those members are Mayor Wheeler, Multnomah County Commissioner Jessica Vega Peterson. The city-appointed citizen member is Tracy Rossi. The county-appointed citizen member is Felicia Tripp Folsom. And the city-appointed business community representative is Mitch Horniker. I'm going to just take you through the funding process, both the planning phase and then the actual application and decision process, and then briefly overview the results and take questions. So the levy, as the mayor said, was renewed by the voters most recently in May 2018. And right after that approval, we go into the planning phase. In the past levies, we have done the planning and the funding round in about a year's time. And after receiving feedback from the community and also doing an equity assessment, we concluded we had to lengthen the planning phase and the funding phase to allow more time for community engagement and examination of how the process was designed. So our goal, we lengthened the planning phase. We basically took it to a two-year process instead of a one-year process total and left about a year or so for the planning phase. Our goals in the planning phase were to increase equity and transparency in all aspects of the funding process, to increase engagement by a diversity of community members in creating the funding priorities and the strategies and the types of programs that we were going to eventually fund, and to provide multiple ways for community members to participate. And then last, to critically assess and redesign the funding process or the proposals through the decision-making process. So those were the goals that we set out with and began with the community engagement process. We hired Empress Rules Equity Consulting with Kiyoshi Owens, principal, and a team of about six people to design and conduct that process. They created, to start out, two surveys, one for community members and one for service providers. We made it clear in the beginning that our goal was to try to reach community members because service providers are usually very interested in talking to us, and community members is a whole other story. So their team really worked hard to engage community members, not just service providers, and they designed two separate surveys for the different groups of people. To give you an understanding of who was in the 400 community members that they reached to respond to the survey, I'm going to run through some of the data they collected on those respondents so you can kind of understand what their point, you know, where they were coming from. 20% of those respondents had children with disabilities. 11% had disabilities themselves. 81% were parents or caregivers to children. 17% were youth. 24% were involved in the foster care system. 19% identified as LGBTQ. 27% had experienced houselessness, 32% were immigrants or refugees, and 48% primarily spoke languages other than English in their homes. So they did an excellent job at reaching deeply into community and getting a lot of points of view and created a really detailed survey that gave us a lot of information about what people thought. In addition to surveys, they also conducted eight focus groups with 85 community members. And those focus groups were also aimed at probing deeply into particular experiences. They provided translation and interpretation for anyone who needed it for focus groups. They conducted two groups in Spanish, particularly, two groups just for youth, one group for immigrant and refugees, one group for foster impacted. So that's people who were either foster children themselves or foster parents. a parent group that was also providers in the community of some kind of service related to children or families. So sometimes teachers or other service providers. And then one disability impacted group. So those are parents who either have a disability or a child with a disability. So that, again, very successful in getting many more people who are from the community and are not just service providers to come to the table and really provide in-depth discussion with them. And lastly, they offered stipends for anyone who participated in this community engagement process in recognition of the time that they were offering. In the past, that's not something that we have done. So after they went through this process and they mined all of the data and themed all of the focus group conversations with their team, they made a series of recommendations to the levy. And those recommendations were primarily centered around equity and also provided information about the types of services that people want to prioritize and all of the different program areas that we have to fund in according to the ballot language. So the overall equity recommendations were to fund services that were culturally relevant and responsive, to make sure that direct service staff reflected the cultures and spoke the languages of the people being served, to make sure that people of color were in leadership positions at the organizations providing the services and at the levy, and that organizations need to include families in the planning and in the evaluation of the programs and the services. They also provided a wealth of information around the types of services that people wanted and how they wanted them delivered. And they also, there were sort of two other major themes that came out of their process. One was around quality and the importance of training for nonprofit staff, particularly in racial equity and trauma-informed service delivery, and also in child and youth development. And last, the importance of transportation across all program areas, making sure that we try to fund programs that either provide transportation or assure transportation to make sure that there's equal access. And in hunger relief, particularly that we do mobile, we consider mobile services, either mobile pantries or food service delivery of some kind. So while the community engagement process was unfolding, we also worked with PSU to do a PSU Center for Improvement of Child and Family Services to do a qualitative evaluation on the overall funding process. So that's kind of the proposal, the application questions, the review process, and the decision-making process that we go through once the application is published. So as I said, PSU Center for Improvement in Child and Family Services with Tuan Dong as the principal investigator, who is just so happens now employed at Portland Housing Bureau as an equity manager. She and her team reviewed the whole funding process from 2014. They looked at all of the written materials associated with it, including applications, proposals, scoring criteria, funding decisions, all of the feedback we gather at the end of the funding round. And they also looked at the city audit of conducted by the city auditor of the children's levy. And part of their investigation. Along with all the written materials, they also interviewed 59 stakeholders, and those included past applicants to the levy and both successful and unsuccessful applicants, local funders, and allocation committee members. When they were finished with all of that review and analysis and theming all of the conversations from the interviews, they created a report and gave us 30 recommendations to prove transparency and equity. I'm not going to run through all 30 of them now because that would be too long, but I'll give you the highlights. And for transparency, some of the things they recommended were creating an online FAQ, publishing all questions and answers that applicants ask about the application so that everybody's got access to it, providing reviewer score sheets before decision-making so applicants could review that, and changing the advocacy rules to assure that there was equal access to allocation committee, to advocating for the allocation committee for anybody's applications. The recommendations to improve equity included changing the application questions, the definitions, and the scoring criteria. And some examples of that were to focus on the equity practices of the organizations that were applying, the percentage of staff and board that identify as people of color, and how organizations provided services in language spoken by clients. They also recommended we change the testimony process and that we create a small grants fund stream to improve equity of access for smaller organizations that typically don't apply in these larger, for the larger grants, or don't have the capacity to. So both Empress Rules and PSU presented their recommendations and reports at public meetings to the allocation committee, And then the allocation committee spent the next 6 months, basically February through September of 2019, taking up those recommendations and operationalizing them into the process design, how it would unfold and the timeline it would unfold and the steps it would include. And then what was in the applications themselves. So making sure that the recommendations from the community ended up in the applications, application questions were reflected in the application questions and the priorities for funding. During that process, folks were still providing input as the committee was working through its decisions through either written input in the between allocation committee meetings or oral input in public testimony at the public meetings. So all of that culminated in the publication of 6 funding applications, we call them requests for investment, in September of 2019. And that kind of concluded the planning phase and started us into the actual funding phase. So after publication of the applications, we received 116 applications for funding, requesting $114 million, which is about $1.7 requested for every dollar available. The staff recruited and trained 63 volunteer community members to do the grant review and score the applications. We used the process to recruit those reviewers that was recommended by PSU. We had an application process and asked people to provide experience they had in the program areas that they were scoring in, and also their lived experience and knowledge on equity, diversity, and inclusion, either through their life or through their work. So that was a change from how we had done review process in the past. We also offered them stipends to recognize their contribution of time, because these are long applications and it takes time and energy to do that. And we set it up so that we had 5 reviewers score each application and then average the scores of those 5 reviewers to get a final application score for each application.
Lisa, before you continue, I just want to make sure Commissioner Hardesty may want to jump in on that slide.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Lisa. Would you go back to the last slide again, please?
Oops, sorry. Wrong one. I went the wrong way. Okay, I'm getting there.
Here we go. So I'm really interested in the 63 volunteers that worked in small groups and scored the applications. What demographic information and experience made up that group of volunteers?
So we used Civic Life's application process to advertise. So we put an application up on the city website so you could apply to be a reviewer. We asked Civic Life to kind of help us do outreach, as well as using partners and allocation committee members to recruit people to review. So on the advice of Civic Life, we are not allowed to ask at the front end any demographic question. We could ask demographic information, but we could not use it to set up to choose the reviewers. So we chose not to ask it at the front end and instead asked people a series of questions on their reviewer application. And that one of those included, what is your experience in the nonprofit or in the arena of the area in which you're interested in reviewing? So are you a child abuse prevention person or someone who has experience in that or whatever the program area was? And then we asked specific questions for what their experience and knowledge was on equity, diversity, and inclusion, and asked people to talk about their either life experience or their professional experience. So we chose, based on what people answer, to try to pick people who had the most experience in the program areas and in EDI. And then we tried to balance each panel to include people, at least 2 people who had specific experience in equity, diversity, and inclusion work of some kind or life experience. And then people who also, pretty much everybody who applied had some program area experience. There was hardly anybody who didn't. So I think people were attracted to the process through that. When we did our feedback survey from the reviewers, 85% of those 63 people responded to that survey, and we asked demographic identity questions on there. 50% were identified as a person of color.
And do you have a further breakdown than that?
I could get you one. I don't have it off the top of my head.
I appreciate that, because I think when you started this long process, the world was working normally. And now that we're here and we're about to deploy the grants, I think that the world has shifted radically since you started this process. And so I am very much interested in kind of the demographic breakdown all across the board. And I really would love to understand how many nonprofit organizations get a lot of money from different pots with the children levy. It would be very helpful to know organizationally the total amount of resources that folks get, because there are some traditional organizations that get resources every year. And then when we collect it together, what we find is this absolute enormous amount of money going to one entity. And so I'm starting to look at that across the city, and it would be very helpful to have that information from the children's levy as well.
I'd be happy to get that to you. It would be easy for me to do.
Thank you.
I will follow up with you on that, Commissioner Hardesty. Oh, shoot. Wait.
Lisa, if I could just add to that.
Yeah.
Commissioner Hardesty's question is a great one. And that was an issue that was front and center during the allocation conversations, since we had limited resources. And as we got to the end in particular, we had to pick and choose. And so the conversation around bundling or multiple different types of grants going to the same organization definitely was raised multiple times as a key issue to be evaluated.
Thank you for that, Mayor, because as we think about investing the CARES dollars and all the other dollars that we're sending out, it's really important that we know exactly how much money we're giving to different organizations, and some who just are the traditional ones who always get it because they are considered organizations that are culturally specific. Mm-hmm. But as we've learned through the CARES Act, there are hundreds of organizations that serve our community that never have access to public funding.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we did the small grants program as well through the levy, was to try and get at some of those other organizations who honestly felt that there were barriers to their receiving funding just based on the structure of the grant process previously.
Thank you.
Absolutely true. And something we're well aware of. Okay, just I'll complete the overview and then we'll go on if you want to ask any specific questions about the recommendations. So staff also reviews all the applications and the scores. We look at past performance as Commissioner Hardesty pointed out, of people asking for continuing funding. And we look at organizational financial health. We make recommendations that are based on that review and also based on balancing the investments in every program area to assure that we're addressing priority populations in each program area and also addressing the prioritized services that came out of community engagement in each program area. So we create our recommendations and provide a written rationale for them. And then we provide all this information to the applicants and to the allocation committee essentially at the same time. So we give both the committee and all the applicants get a ranked list by score of all of the programs that have applied for funding in that program area. It includes a lot of all the basic information, how much they applied for, who they're serving, et cetera. So we provide that. We give them our recommendations and the rationale. So that's a written document. We recommend this for this much money for this reason. And then we give them the copies of their reviewer score sheets. So that's the score sheets that all those volunteer reviewers filled out on their application. So the committee gets it and the applicants get it. And then after that, the applicants were invited to submit testimony, either written or oral testimony in support of their application. And just to be clear, there was no other advocacy permitted to allocation committee members except this testimony. This was at the advice of PSU into trying to create a more equal playing field, because many people felt some people had relationships or access. And we decided that we would just not do that. Everybody would get the same opportunity. So you had a certain amount of written testimony and then a certain number of minutes of oral testimony you could provide. We had intended to do video recording in person so that clients could come and make it, kind of address that community participation side, but the COVID prevented that. So we had to cancel the in-person and we did just audio recording of testimony via Zoom instead. All that oral testimony and all the written testimony was then packaged and sent to the committee, as well as made available to the applicant. So all applicants could see everybody's testimony if they chose. So the committee then basically was working with the reviewers' scores and information from the scoring process, the staff recommendations, and then the testimony that was provided by the applicants as they came into the two public meetings in which they make the decisions that are before you today, the recommendations for funding. So the decisions were made in late April and early May, and that's what is before you today. So this slide just gives you a sense for how the money is divided by program area. And we had sort of target allocations or planned allocations for each program area, and then the final allocations. And you can see they differ somewhat, in most cases not by too much. But for instance, and those the differences are usually related to the type and the quality and the number of applications that are received in each program area. And here in mentoring, there were a greater number of high quality applications that the committee wanted to fund than the original allocation would allow for. So they decided to move money from other program areas to that program area so they could fund more of those applications. And then just at the most macro level for the funding decisions, you've got a list of all 85 grants that are attached to the ordinance, should be in your paperwork that was submitted to council for this. So you have all the detail. I'm not going to read all 85 grants to you. But just at the macro level, of those 85, 22 are for new programs. And so examples of some new agencies that are funded include Black Parent Initiative, Oregon Community Health Workers Association, the Contingent, Oregon Mesa, Lutheran Community Services, and Familias en Acción. There were 10 expansions for currently funded programs, primarily to serve priority populations or provide a service that was prioritized in community engagement. And some examples of that, and kind of Commissioner Harsey, this is a little bit to your point, Latino Network was funded for 4 new programs. So they were already a grantee as an agency, but they were funded for 4 new programs in this round, 2 after school, 1 foster care, and 1 mentoring program. NEA was funded for a new child abuse prevention program, and POIC was funded for new foster care, after school, and hunger relief programming. 53 of the grants are continuing grants to maintain current services, so that's services that we are currently funding. Some examples of the expansions are ERCO received expansions of current grants and early childhood, child abuse, after school, and mentoring. To serve Pacific Islander and Middle Eastern populations, which our data show are being underserved in levy programs over the last several years. And so we were specifically looking to make sure that we were providing programming for those communities. Latino Network and REAP and El Programa all received expansion funding to provide their programming at additional sites. So these are folks who are offering services at schools and are looking for expansion to provide those services at more schools. Of course, assuming that we can open schools in the fall. Okay, that's the end of the formal presentation. I'm happy to take any questions about either the process or the grants themselves. And Mayor Wheeler, feel free to jump in and your perspective on the process too.
Very good. I thought you did a thorough job. Colleagues, any questions? Commissioner Hardesty, is that a residual hand raise or do you have a new question?
No, it's a new hand raise. Thank
you. Excellent. You're up.
Thank you, Lisa. I also believe that you did a very thorough job. I appreciate you laying out kind of the thinking and the planning and the process and a very detailed process that was planned for before we had a pandemic, before we had an economic collapse, and before we had a revolution. So my question is, after all that very detailed, thought out, intentional work, are there resources now that could be utilized to address the 3 emergencies that I've just identified? And if so, what's the process to actually be able to allocate those funds out in new creative ways?
Well, basically what we decided to do, because of all the things you just noticed, and this is really what the committee asked us to do. So in consultation with the committee, we asked them, what do you want us to do? All of these organizations are helping people on the front lines right now today, and they are using our money. We gave people, so that all of the organizations that are current grantees are using Portland Children's Levy money right now to address the pandemic and other related issues as we speak, so that we gave them flexibility to use their current funding to address the pandemic in whatever ways we're going to help the community the most. So we basically, on direction from the committee, want to provide that same flexibility moving forward. So we have sort of rewritten our grant template to include a sort of non-COVID pandemic situation. Here's the program that you said you wanted to deliver and that the committee said they wanted to fund. What do you plan to do for that? And then while the state of emergency is in effect and physical distancing and needs are escalating and the economic situation is deteriorating, what are you going to do in that period of time to address community needs and write a separate set of planned activities for that time period, or for the transition, if we have a transition, or when we have a transition out of the emergency period. So that was the best way we could think of to create that flexibility. And the committee was very much focused on trying to have, and in fact, Tracy Rossi was really an advocate, like she really wanted to move forward with the funding round and give people flexibility, because these are the folks who are going to be addressing the frontline needs of community in this pandemic. So that's the best way we could come up with to use the funds flexibly. Small grants fund is unrolling right now. And so you're going to see grants come before you again that I think are going to very much be addressing the immediate needs of the community.
Thank you for that. And so the question is, how are you going to track outcomes based on the shift and all the three things that I just mentioned? And what's going to be the outcomes, and how are we tracking to make sure we're not just, you know, we're not just throwing money away, but we're actually investing it in maintaining people now and actually building for a new reality whenever that starts?
Well, that's an excellent question. And every contract we have that we write has outcomes in it. So I think our point was to try to be flexible. I mean, people have outcomes that they put in their grant agreements, and I'm convinced that if they can, or in their grant proposals, I'm sorry, and they will be able, if they are able to deliver their program as planned, they will absolutely be able to measure those outcomes. And I think some programs haven't had to adapt that much to deliver their services. They are doing it right now. They're doing it virtually. They're finding other ways. And they will be able to measure outcomes similarly because they are delivering their services in a similar enough manner. Other folks is not going to be, and that's, we're going to have to work on something new. So we always measure outputs, Commissioner Hardesty. So we'll always be looking at, you know, like for hunger relief, for instance, we're looking at, are you providing food and who are you providing it to and what kind of food are you providing? So we'll always look at those things, and that won't change. I just think that the outcomes, the effect on the children and the families that are receiving the services may have to be altered. We're going to have to negotiate with the grantees exactly what those outcomes are going to look like and how they're going to measure them in a pandemic. So I think we're trying to be flexible, but right, hold people too accountable at the same time.
Well, I really appreciate that, Lisa. Let me just say that it's challenging for all of us at this moment, right, to be accountable for investments of public dollars, at the same time providing flexibility, and at the same time trying to identify new community partners who can help us provide the services. Mm-hmm. For me, I just want to make sure that we are tracking what it is that we are investing in, because like the children's levy is very separate, right? But this is a significant pot of money. You're sending $68 million out the door, right? Mm-hmm. And that is money that's coming from homeowners who have once again agreed that an investment in early childhood care is the right thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. And all of us are in favor of that. But as I look at collectively, the money that Prosper Portland puts out the door, the money that the Housing Bureau puts out the door, the money that the Joint Office of Housing Services puts out the door. And when I look and I see the same organizations on all those lists, it starts to create real concern for me, because I don't see any kind of big picture thinking about what is it that we're investing in and who are we investing in? And then are we making sure that the resources are distributed broad enough to have the biggest impact, right? Because I know governments talk about frontline communities and they talk about racially specific services, right? But that's not the same thing of actually having access to services that you want and need in a way that you need it. I live in East Portland, and so I don't need to go to North Portland if I have a service need. I should be able to get my needs met right in East Portland where I live. And so I don't know that our systems actually allow us to holistically look at whether or not we're making the right investments in the right places at the right time.
I mean, I think that's an excellent question and one that we don't have a great answer to. I'm not sure at the city level what would make sense to do that, but I agree with you that's something that's information we could all use, frankly, in trying to, and that our committee could use in making decisions. If they had the whole picture in addition to what is being presented as proposals, it would be so much more useful. I'm not sure what the best next step to accomplish that is, but I think it's absolutely the right thing we should do.
I don't know either. And I know we're struggling with that around the CARES Act dollars. But for me, just at the 18 months I've been here, it's just really obvious that we don't have a big picture perspective of how we invest our dollars. So, Mayor, I don't know what to do with that, but this has been a good conversation, Lisa, and I definitely appreciate the thoroughness of your presentation.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate
you. Thank you, Commissioner. Lisa, does that complete your presentation?
That completes the presentation.
Very good. Colleagues, did you have any other questions before we go to public testimony? Seeing none, Carla, do we have public testimony on this item?
I do not show anyone signed up for this one, Mayor.
All right, very good. Then with that, this is an emergency ordinance. Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
I want to thank the members of the Portland Children's Levy. Mayor, I know you are a integral part of that committee, as well as Commissioner Vega Peterson. I know how thoughtful both of you are around these issues. I can't say I know the other players as well. You know, these may be the perfect investments. I don't know. I will take your word that they are, and I will vote in favor. But I would like to continue that conversation as we start really refocusing how the city spends its limited resources about how do we get to that place where all of us have a big picture vision about where we're investing those dollars and whether or not we are spreading out city resources in a way that really benefits the people that we continue to say we want to benefit. And so I vote aye, and I look forward to continuing this conversation in another forum and working with both Lisa and the committee to figure out what's the best way to do that. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you, Commissioner.
Hugh Daly.
Thank you for the presentation. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Well, thanks as always to the taxpayers of Portland for funding these programs and to Commissioner Saltzman for establishing it. And that's one of his legacies. Thank you, Lisa Pellegrino, for the work that you're doing and the very thoughtful way that you have been paying attention to equity over the past several years. I'm very pleased to vote aye.
Wheeler.
Lisa, I want to thank you for your presentation, and I want to thank you for your longstanding leadership and stewardship of the Portland Children's Levy. Yes, I definitely want to also acknowledge Commissioner Saltzman. This was part of the vision he had of taking this to the public and having the public play an active role in supporting the development of young people in our community. I remember when Nancy Pelosi came to Portland when President Barack Obama was, well, he wasn't president yet. He was still a candidate, and there was a Women for Obama event, and it was held at my house. I was not the host. My then wife, Katrina, was the host, but Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, was sort of the guest of honor, and she was going to come in, and she was going to talk about why people in Portland should support Barack Obama for president. She came late because she probably had a bunch of different arrangements scheduled in advance, but she stopped as she was going up the stairs and looked at the yard sign that we had in our front yard for the Portland Children's Levy. And she really did a second take, and she said, wait a minute, what is that? And right there on the stairs, we had about a 10-minute conversation about what the Children's Levy was, what the philosophy was behind it, about how the public was engaged in this process and supporting the development of our youth. And I remember she was just really impressed with it and thought it was a great model for civic support of children in our community. It's a real honor to serve as the chair of the Children's Levy. I promised Commissioner Saltzman prior to his departing the city council that I would do that because he wanted to make sure that there wasn't a break or a transitional period. I'm really privileged to serve on that committee with some fantastic people. And I can assure you all, they work very, very hard alongside the levy staff to make thoughtful disbursements with regard to which organizations got the services, how those resources were allocated. And there's been a lot of thought Commissioner Hardesty focused on just what you expressed earlier, which is there a way to get newer organizations, smaller organizations, some of these resources, because they're now acting on issues that are maybe emerging issues, particularly in our communities of color, that can help provide culturally specific services to help support our youth, particularly those that are struggling in our community. And I am very pleased to say that that work is well underway, and it is a focus of the Children's Levy team, as well as the entire allocation committee. With that, happy to vote aye. Thank you, Lisa, again, for a good presentation. The ordinance is adopted. Next up is item 493. It is our last item for today, but by no means our least important item for today. Carla, if you could read 493, and thank you, Lisa.
Amend Street Access Code and Transportation Administrative Rules to align with changes to the residential infill project.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Before us today is a reading on a very straightforward and simple ordinance that will amend Title 17 of our city code, the title that deals with our streets, so that it will work with changes to Title 33, our zoning code, that are being proposed in the residential infill project. In February of this year, representatives from the Cully Association of Neighbors, Verde, Habitat for Humanity, and the Native American Youth Association reached out with concerns that a proposed infrastructure amendment to the residential infill project. I'm glad you find this so amusing, Mayor. It's your giant face I get to see right now.
I love everything you're saying. T and I are having a private moment.
Fine. I reduced your screen. You were distracting me. Anyhow, Habitat for Humanity and the Native American Youth Association reached out with concerns that a proposed infrastructure amendment to the residential infill project would exclude large portions of Cully, East Portland, and other pockets of the city. They raised these concerns with my staff and proposed a simple and elegant solution, allowing property owners on curbless streets to pay into the local transportation infrastructure charge, or LTIC, fund if they wanted to add housing units to their property under our amended zoning code. Thanks to their attention and advocacy and quick problem solving, my staff was able to direct the Portland Bureau of Transportation to amend Title 17 to allow this and ensure that we are not penalizing neighborhoods where the city has historically underinvested in streets and sidewalks while building resources that will be used to construct sidewalks and streets throughout the city, very often in these same neighborhoods where the charge is being collected. Christine Leon, Transportation Development Group Manager, and Bob Kellett, Transportation Planner, will quickly walk us through the code changes and are available to answer any questions before we take public testimony. I hope they're here. I see Bob. And there's Christine. Hello, welcome.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioner Udaly, and other members of council. Can I just say I commend you on your stamina? It's like these are long days. So again, my name is Christine Leanne, and I work for the Portland Bureau of Transportation as the lead for the Development, Permitting, and Transit Group. Today, I'm introducing to you a change in city code which allows certain types of residential development to pay the local transportation infrastructure charge, or LTIC. If approved, this change will allow residential development anticipated under the Residential Infill Project, or RIP, to move through PBOT permitting in a timely and predictable manner by requiring that they contribute to improving to deficient public street infrastructure through the LTIC. So briefly, I'll share the history of the LTIC and describe what it is. In 2016, Council passed the LTIC ordinance. Prior to this, infill housing redevelopment occurring on streets without adequate surfacing, stormwater, runoff systems, and pedestrian areas were typically not contributing anything in the way of improvements, nor were they financially contributing to solve the street's infrastructure deficiencies. Piecemeal infrastructure was often not required by the city, partially because it's prohibitively expensive for new development to provide isolated frontage improvements on curbless streets. So the LTIC was established in 2016 to specifically address the city's growth and deficient infrastructure problem. The LTIC guarantees that development contributes through payment of this local transportation infrastructure charge, unless the frontage is built to standards, and then nothing has to be done. The LTIC is not an in lieu fee, it's not a tax, and it's not an impact fee. The LTIC is a charge paid at the time of development for developers to build on less than standard streets. So it's applied to single dwelling zones on local service streets. It's assessed based on a dollar per linear footage of local street frontage. And then following in the spring of 2018, council approved the LTIC allocation methodology, which is essentially how decisions will be made on the expenditures of the LTIC revenue to make street improvements through the system of local streets in the city of Portland. So Bob's going to describe a little bit more detail on transportation's planning's analysis of the RIP and how the two are joined. So take it away, Bob.
Thank you, Christine, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners. I'm Bob Killett. I'm a planner with PBOT. In assessing the potential transportation impacts from RIP, we primarily looked at two things. The first is the impacts to the transportation system as a whole. What we found was while the potential new housing from RIP does change the location and patterns of some of the transportation trips we'd expect to see over the next 20 years, the cumulative impacts of it is small and something our plan system can handle. The second impact we looked at was at the site development level. In other words, where do we expect the middle housing to occur? And do these areas have the transportation infrastructure to support it? In this analysis, we saw that some new housing will likely occur on currently underimproved residential streets. These are the streets that are identified as being eligible for payments into LTIC when the program was created, with LTIC being one of the tools we have available to us to build out the supportive infrastructure over time. As Christine mentioned, LTIC resides in Title 17 of the City Code. As it's currently written, the City Code allows the LTIC payment by an applicant for a new residential building permit for a project of one or two units on a property that has a frontage on an underimproved local service traffic street maintained by the city. And as you all are aware, after the hearings with RIP, it's proposing to expand the housing types that are allowed on these residential streets. The Title 17 code, as it currently is written, would not allow property owners seeking to build middle housing types like triplexes or fourplexes to pay into the LTIC. The ordinance before you today amends Title 17 to allow for developers of these middle housing types to pay into the LTIC, just as a developer of a single family home or a duplex would be able to. It basically aligns what is being proposed for Title 33 of the zoning code in RIP with the Title 17 code that guides LTIC. It enables the city to collect the charge on the new housing types permitted by RIP in locations where LTIC applies and where the housing types will be allowed. So again, the only thing the ordinance changes is the allowable housing types that are eligible to pay into LTIC. At the locations where single family homes and duplexes can currently pay into LTIC, housing types up to six units will now be able to pay into the LTIC to help meet the city's infrastructure needs. The administrative rules also guiding LTIC will be updated to reflect these changes. So with that, we're happy to take any questions before testimony. We also have Morgan Tracy, the Residential Infill Project Manager for BPS, with us today as well, if there are any RIP-specific questions.
Yeah, you were wise to ask for RIP-specific questions, because I was just going to ask if you have a guest room, and if so, what time should I show up?
Anytime.
There's a screen in the background. Colleagues, I see Commissioner Fritz and then Commissioner Hardesty. Commissioner Fritz, you're up.
Actually, Commissioner Hardesty had her hand up first, Mayor.
I think that's residual. Is that Commissioner Hardesty, or do you have a new question? Are you on mute, Commissioner Hardesty?
Sorry, I'm good. I've had my question answered. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Fritz, you're up.
Thank you. I'm the only one who was on the council in 2016 when we passed this. Was that right? Or were others of you on? No. So could you tell the folks why we decided only to have it allowed to single family or to one or two units? Why we didn't allow it for multifamily?
Sure. So we had a code that really differentiated between three and fewer units and three and more units back prior to 2016. And essentially when there's more units, we would have really fought hard to compel the developer to make the improvements because of the additional load on the streets. So we focused on the residential streets and single family, essentially because the higher classification streets and the multifamily density, we were compelling developers to build that. I will say prior to 2016, we had a strong practice of requiring waivers of remonstrance with the hope that the residents that had the burden of the waiver on their property put on by the developer would eventually improve their streets comprehensively. That's not happening. So this change was put into place essentially to allow development to continue and to pay their fair share.
Thank you. And does this amendment apply only to middle housing, or is it all new development, including expensive new development?
So this change in code allows the type of developments that are anticipated under the RIP to be developed by paying an LTIC charge. So there are in our administrative rules exemptions, and those cover affordable housing developments and ADUs. So there's kind of a laundry list of where LTIC and the RIP align. If you want us to go through that, we can do that. I might ask Morgan to kind of run through so everybody is clear on what is going to be assessed and what isn't. But essentially, there's not a threshold other than affordable housing for who would get an exemption.
Thank you, Christine. So this is Morgan Tracy with the Bureau of Planning Sustainability Project Manager for the Residential Infill Project. A little warm up for tomorrow. So just to answer your question, Commissioner Fritz, I think you're asking whether there's a differentiation between lower priced housing and luxury housing with the LTIC. And the response to that is it's a flat fee assessed at $600 a lineal foot based on the amount of frontage. And it doesn't differentiate based on the type of housing, so a duplex, triplex, or a luxury single family home, except for, as Christine mentioned, there are waivers for affordable housing projects.
Thank you. And then where can the LTIC money be used? Where does it fund new improvements?
So back in 2018, Council approved the expenditure methodology, and there was a number of criteria that were put in place as far as effectiveness, equity, and efficiency. And so the bureaus have been developing the project list to meet the City Council's requirements as far as the expenditure methodology.
And how much is in the LTIC funding at this point?
Since this has been adopted, there's about $4.5 million that are it's obligated to be spent on the residential street improvements per the council adopted methodology.
And final question, if a property pays into the LTIC, are they then they're not waivered, they are not required to pay into a local street improvement, is that correct?
So far, we have not seen any LIDs that are happening as a result of the LTIC. And so that's certainly something that we are going to consider when an LID is formed, as far as has any of these properties paid the LTIC? Do they have a waiver of remonstrance? Great question.
But did we not put into the ordinance that if you paid the LTIC, you then were not required to pay into an LID?
That's the intent, that we don't want to double dip and charge the residents if they paid for that fee when they bought the house, say from the developer. Yes.
So then is it true to say that if you're in a development on an undeveloped street that's not a neighborhood collector or a priority area, that your street is not ever going to get developed?
So the allocation methodology is really focused on making sure that we as a city are building what the council and what the residents want with the high equity and opportunity factors in there. We're partnering with other bureaus and really focusing on the safe routes, the connections that are essential. It would be great to be able to get more money to build every deficient street. Depending on where we are and how much the RIP will be able to fund, we can certainly do more. I don't expect that we're going to be able to build everything, but we're using some of the 2012 council adopted standards that allow the money to go further with the improvements on the shared streets. So system-wide, things will get built on the priority, but there's not necessarily a guarantee that anytime soon a house that has paid the LTIC will get the improvements in front of that house.
Thank you, Christine. I appreciate your long-time leadership and all of the work that you've done. Also, Bob, for briefing me and my staff. I appreciate your answers.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Dang it, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you. It's funny. So this morning when I asked questions, I would make Commissioner Fritz think of questions. And Commissioner Fritz's questions made me think of a question. And here's my question. What do you mean when you say affordable housing?
Oh, yeah. My bad. We're talking about the Portland Housing Bureau's standard of affordability, which is at 80% MFI or below.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to make sure we had that on the record, that we were all on the same page, 80% or below MFI. Is that what you said, Morgan?
Correct.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Very good. Any further questions? Is there a public testimony on this item, Carla?
Yes, Mayor, we have four people signed up.
Great.
The first person is David Sweet.
Hello, David.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners, and thank you for hanging in there on such a long and momentous day. My name is David Sweet, and I'm representing the Cully Association of Neighbors and six other place-based community organizations working to preserve our diversity and prevent the displacement of low-income people, indigenous and tribal people, and people of color from Cully. Our neighborhood is mostly zoned for single-family homes, and recent development has taken the form of the type of large, expensive houses that are driving displacement. For these reasons, Cully stands to benefit from the residential infill project. The prospect that our frequently large lots could be developed with three or four or even six smaller, less costly homes instead of just one could mean greater opportunities for people with moderate incomes to rent or own. The proposed amendment to the LTIC is necessary to allow Cully to benefit from the housing options available with RIP. Half of our lots are on partially improved curbless streets. Without this amendment, the cost of street improvements will discourage the development of small plexes in favor of the expensive houses that are driving displacement. These would continue to be built as they are today on curbless streets and paying the LTIC. We think the LTIC is great. It's a smart change from the old system of waivers of remonstrance, which shifted the responsibility from the developer to the homeowner and rarely resulted in any street improvements. Cully has many properties with such waivers signed decades ago and never acted on. And when a developer is required to improve the street in Cully, it results in piecemeal infrastructure disconnected from any other and largely useless. Rather than producing many 50-foot long orphan sidewalks, the LTIC banks the money to develop whole blocks at either current or alternative street standards. Cully looks forward to the improvement of three blocks of Northeast 66th Avenue this year or next using LTIC funds. I live on a quarter mile long block on a curbless street in Cully. Two new developments under construction there are building half street improvements. That will give us a total of 4 orphan sidewalks on that quarter mile and orphan curbs. None of them connect with each other. We will all still walk in the street. Cully does not need any more orphans. We need moderately priced and affordable housing and the rational street improvements that come with the LTIC. We urge you to adopt this amendment.
Thank you, Dave.
Next is Ezra Hammer.
Welcome, Ezra.
Good afternoon, Honorable Mayor and Honorable Commissioners. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. Thank you for your diligent work and all of your hard work today working on such important issues. Very briefly, I'd just like to echo some of the wonderful comments from David. Like many of the nonprofits that Commissioner Udaly mentioned, the Home Builders Association has been a strong supporter of this amendment. This is a wonderful opportunity to ensure that middle housing can be built throughout our entire city, and that, as David mentioned, when housing is built, funds are collected in a manner that allow for the rational and most appropriate development of sidewalks per the City Council's direction. I want to give a special thanks to Christine and her team for working so diligently on this. We are really appreciative of all of her hard work and urge you to move forward with the adoption of this amendment today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ezra.
Doug Klotz.
Hello, Doug.
Hello, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. I support the LTIC changes that are proposed that will allow threeplexes, fourplexes, and even sixplexes to use this option. This change will help the residential infill project reach its full potential and allow building in areas with less expensive lots. It will especially benefit East Portland, where many streets are unimproved. And it, as David has pointed out, this will also benefit Cully and parts of Southwest. Rather than the builder putting in a short piece of street and curb and sidewalk, using the LTIC will generate funding to build street improvements where they help the most people, such as routes leading to transit, schools, and services, and they can be built up in a rational manner, starting at the arterials and working their way back into the neighborhood in a sequence that makes sense. So I support this.
Thank you very much, Doug. We appreciate it. And Carla, there was one more individual. Is that correct?
Yes, John Gibbon.
Hello, John. Thanks for
being here. Thank you, your mayor. I really want to compliment you all on your efforts today to avoid racial, occupational, and tenure-based disparate community safety outcomes. I think that Sweeney, which is one of the organizations I'm representing here today, so certainly supports that. We may disagree on some of the details. We can't support the RIP or we can't support the LTIC amendment to RIP at this point because we are of the opinion that we haven't seen any RIP developments in Southwest. We know that curbed paved streets are critical to address stormwater, particularly where stormwater is managed through control and conveyance on a paved street. And we're concerned that when RIP was adopted and the fees were set, we exempted out BES numbers that were going to come in to address that problem. And if staff can show that those BES numbers have come in and been built into the $600 cost, well then, you know, maybe it would get better. Otherwise, we have areas in Markham, the neighborhood I represent, and other areas in the Southwest where if you don't take account of stormwater costs related to this kind of program, you'll be enhancing deficits in stormwater management if RIP doesn't have that money to do that. I can give you some examples from Markham itself where I've got some concerns. I also would say I'm representing representing my homeowners association, which is the Quail Park Association. And we have some additional concerns related to how this LTIC will operate in relation to private streets. And I'll start with that one. I've discussed this before. If you look at Southwest Huber and Southwest 28th Street, we have several properties that are one property deep on one side and LTIC Street on the other side are private streets. We're really concerned that you could pay an LTIC fee, change your access, or maybe not change your access and use our private street to access a property like that. That's a concern, a big one. Then in other parts of Markham, we have areas between 17th and west to the Tryon Creek watershed branch that comes down at about 23rd. Those areas are heavily LTIC streets. Some improvements have been done on a pilot program, but those streets are going to need stormwater conveyance paid for in some way before they're developed to RIP densities. And they're not included in the Z zone, which is a great concern to us. And last, I'd mention the problem with RIP is that the Z zone designation in some cases have landed on things like Southwest 23rd, where it's a fully improved, relatively new street that should have some adequate stormwater capacity. It's right next to the creek, yet it's given a Z designation because it's next to the creek and it's not taking account of the fully improved street. So until we can see proof that the stormwater issue is really going to be dealt with by the LTIC program, and understand, we support LTIC, and we understand that the equation is different in the Cully neighborhood and other neighborhoods where infiltration is possible. It's not in Southwest, so we've got to reserve our support for this at this time.
All right. Thank you, John. Thank you for your perspective. We appreciate it, all four of you. Carla, that completes our public testimony. Is that correct?
That does, Mayor. Yes.
Great. Colleagues, before I send this on, are there any other questions that you want to put on the table right now? Very good. With that, then, this is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading, and we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Carla.
You're welcome.